mean, some will win, some will lose. Some are born to sing the blues. As always, David Biscuit. Hello, David.
Hey, man, how are you doing?
I'm doing a lot better than the employees at the Winklevoss twins recently laid off at Gemini. To make Gemini better for the long term, a lot of people lost their jobs because of, some would call, just an unraveling scam. Others would say price discovery on a global currency. Who knows? Who's to say which is which? But we'll be discussing that and more tonight on the show.
Yeah, we got a fun one coming for y'all. In just a little bit, we're going to be joined by our good friends, Danny Bessner and Derek Davison of the American Prestige Pod, among other incredible things. They are joining us to talk about Joe Biden's trip to Saudi Arabia, a little bit on Ukraine, and also answering the question about whether or not Biden's sort of failure and disastrous summit of the Americas might signal a shift in power in the Americas. A lot of fun stuff to get to, and just reminding folks, all of June we're doing our summer streams where we're going to be releasing our post game, which is typically for members only, our patrons. We're going to be releasing those to the public on twitch.tv/leftreckoning. We got a lot of fun stuff coming up with that. The ultimate lad, my good friend, Rob McPherson, will be joining us to talk a few things. We're going to be talking Bernie Sanders versus Lindsey Graham. We're going to be talking Cornel West's incredible speech that he gave at the protest outside of the Summit of the Americas. And as always, taking your questions and your voicemails as well. So be sure to tune in for that immediately after the show.
David, do you remember Fareed Zakaria of CNN writing those books, The Post-American World?
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Like, I feel like that stuff's all forgotten. Like, Fareed is, I think, didn't he have some plagiarism thing? Like, he's kind of disappeared from the scene.
I can't remember what happened with him. I mean, did they get rid of him at CNN?
I haven't seen him in ages.
That's true.
It's funny, like me thinking of like seeing The Post-American World on Barnes & Noble, and I actually bought that book. and to see like actually like what that plays out and like who actually I look to for guidance on that.
Dude, the current affairs section at like Barnes & Noble, there'd be monsters there. That's a dark, dark place. I know.
For me, I sympathize. Yeah. Like, actually, this is one of the services this show tries to provide, is like a guide to that, right? Because like I was the dumb idiot buying Hot, Flat, and Crowded, thinking like, oh, this is brain nourishment. Tom Friedman's book about how like I think it's the one where he says like places don't go to war if they have both have McDonald's or something like that, like, or maybe that's a different one, but anyway, like I it's like New York Times, what more do you need?
No, I mean, much better than me though, Matt, because I have to admit I might have bought a couple Sean Hannity books in my youth at Barnes & Noble. But actually, like on that, not to do too much teasing up top, this weekend for patrons, we're going to be releasing a bonus episode, a conversation with C. Derek Varn on the anatomy of the current right-wing movement, and most importantly, on the question of does right-wing populism exist, and if it does, what is its appeal? We're going to be joined by C. Derek Varn. I'm really looking forward to actually breaking down like the current status of things. And also, I don't know, maybe breaking down some of my early life flirtations with the right wing. So be sure to catch that, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
That's very interesting. Yeah. I mean, the closest thing I had was I got into like 9/11 conspiracies a little bit, but then like sort of reacted against that, but never had a conservative face.
Very, very embarrassing.
Yeah, I did watch, I guess I will say I'd like Bush against Gore to the extent I had an opinion. And I did tune into Shock and Awe, hoping to, you know, see some like good stuff, and it left with a different feeling. But yeah, that'd be a fun conversation.
But yeah, I mean, I don't think we could dance around it too much longer though, Matt. Should we get into this first segment here? We're going to be talking about the crypto crash. You know, sort of some of the things that are going on, and then towards the end, breaking down some of the real material basis here, because prepare yourself. A lot of these kind of whiny libertarians are going to try to use this moment to take aim at institutions that we should have a hell of a lot of criticisms of, but not the ones that the right wing will be making.
Absolutely. Well, first, let's to start with this crypto thing. Well, we played the Winklevoss playing Don't Stop Believing in the cold open. We also they also played Rage Against the Machine. it's not Testify. It's the one where it's some of those who work forces are the same that burn crosses. Mm-hmm. Great song. Interesting coming from, you know, Silicon Valley tech investors. announced layoffs. You go jam out after you have to do something hard like lay off a bunch of people. But the Crypto Brothers cited difficulties related to current macroeconomic and geopolitical turmoil. It forced them to slash jobs for the first time since they founded Gemini in 2014. Today is a tough day, but one that will make Gemini better over the long run. I'm sure that feels good for the people that let go. Constraint is the mother of innovation, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, so the Twins' band is called Mars Junction, and they do have upcoming tour dates.
I guess they have a lot of time now.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, the Gemini layoffs also came amid a lawsuit by the Commodity Futures Trading Commission accusing the company of making false and misleading statements concerning a Bitcoin futures contract the firm was pursuing in 2017. So tough stuff. You hate to see anybody lose their jobs. It would be nice to have this economy structured where good paying jobs wasn't helping pump bullshit scams for, you know, tech bros. We have some other stuff, though. More sympathetic than the Winklevi is the Golden State Warriors. Now, I like both teams in the current NBA Finals. I'd be very rationally speaking, I really like Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart. I like those guys win a title at the young age. That's very interesting to me. I must say, I have found myself rooting for the Warriors. Steph Curry. Like at the age, I think it's because I'm like that generation of age where it's like I want to see them still get it done a little bit. So like I find myself pulled towards the Warriors. But if I wanted to hate the Warriors, there's one element of it that I would emphasize, and it's their crypto bullshit. So folks might, if you tune into the NBA Finals, have seen this advertisement in the most recent in Game 5. For those,
Jesus Christ.
For those listening, it's a whole bunch of tweets saying crypto is dead. And of course, you know.
Dated different times.
Yeah. Like everyone's always knocked it when people have lost their hats. Crypto is dead, long live crypto. That's Coinbase. So go to the Warriors. Here's an article in SF Gate by Gabe Fernandez, good reporter. How a $2 trillion crypto crash is even affecting the Golden State Warriors. The Warriors got into NFTs last April. They announced this one here, which people can see. It's a six-sided ring, which has all the world championships of the that the Warriors have won, going back to, I believe, when they were the Philadelphia Warriors, my understanding. That sold at the time for almost $1 million, $970,000, okay. Which is a lot of money. And that was at the height of Ethereum was peaking at that point. Really a good time for crypto as opposed to now. Fast forward. So in April 2022, the Warriors returned for round two of NFT drops. The focus of the series was on the future rather than the past. I would just like to make one note on this, actually, before we move on. So the Warriors are about to win a seventh. They're about to win a seven championship, which means that like the sixth championship ring, it's kind of like how Tom Brady, did you hear about him? He auctioned off this football, the last
football he ever threw. Yeah.
Auctioned off for $500,000 or something like that. And then the next day comes back into the league and unretires is the funniest thing. And I mean, that's actually what's going to happen to the six sided ring when they get the seventh one. I mean, first of all, I want to make this clear. That's not the only reason this is going to lose in value. It's going to lose in value because all of them, none of them are selling for the original price they were bought for. Maybe totally. Not none of them. That might be an exaggeration. Go ahead, David.
Just want to remind folks, especially people who might be listening, that the ring we're talking about is not a real thing. It's an NFT, you know, picture of or yes. A small short video.
But you know, the funny thing that they do with this stuff is they'll actually throw in like, oh, we actually got a real ring from like a jeweler to throw in, which is like, okay, yeah, that's like the
you
real
better thing. If you're paying nearly $1 million.
Exactly. So keep that in mind. Right. So, and that's where this other stuff comes in because people, I think need, I realize they need a little bit more than just this digital receipt. Give me some fucking access. Give me some, you know, some backstage access, some fun events, exclusivity. The new NFT drops focused on the future of the past. The value of the new NFTs was supposed to be connected in part to how the Warriors do this postseason. NFT buyers, which, like, they're doing very well, so this should be great for this perfect conditions for this experiment. Mm-hmm. How the Warriors do this postseason, NFT buyers receive additional utilities and benefits. I mean, it sounds like fucking Democrats talking about healthcare plans. For every round the team advances, this includes coveted fan prizes like autographed jerseys, again, actually valuable, real things, mm-hmm. And a seat on the championship parade float. Okay, that's weird. There was an additional twist to the second drop. Buyers didn't have to put their money into crypto to purchase almost any of the NFTs. The only exception to the rule was the aforementioned prize, jewel of the collection. One of one NFT called Gold Bar All Access Pass, only available via Ethereum bid. In addition to the NFT, the winning bidder is supposed to receive a physical gold bar, which we estimated the cost of about $9,800, and two tickets to every Warriors playoff game. Again, that's a very valuable thing. Never mind the fucking NFT, right? There's no reason for this to be on some sort of extremely redundant accounting technology. People have been doing tickets for basketball games for a while. But it's safe to say the Warriors fans are not dying to acquire the team's 2022 one-of-one NFT. The highest bid that the item ended up at 10 Ethereum, valued at the time of the bid at $30,000, now valued at about $20,000 after the latest crypto dip. That's 3.5% of the 2021 one-of-one item sold for. It's also not even close to the 25 Ethereum buy now price of Warriors set and hardly shattering records as the team predicted. The physical gold bar itself that's included with the NFT is worth, as far as we can tell, about half of the total value of the one-to-one package. So you're buying a gold bar and doubling the price of that gold with a really expensive sort of climate not attacking receipt. And as for the rest of the nearly 3,000 NFTs originally valued at $500 a piece, things aren't going much better. At a glance at the lower end of the sales offers on the team's 2022 playoff NFT collection shows that at least 49 NFTs are already being resold, which means, shit, I put fucking money into this and I need actual money back, are already being resold at buy now prices below the value they were purchased for just a month ago. So, like, fucking sports fans that don't know shit saw the Steph Curry ad saying, you're not an expert on crypto, but you don't need to be with this fancy app. You can do it securely. And now they realize, well, I got some fucking useless thing that I was told was going to be the future. Thousands of other NFTs on the page have been made available for bidding without the option to buy now, but only two have received actual bids and neither are serious. For instance, after selling for $500 on April 15th, the Golden State Warriors 2015 championship ring number 18 NFT's highest bid sits at $21.
Jesus Christ.
So yeah, let's not go here yet. So let's save that.
Oh, sorry. I thought you got your sound drop on. No, I mean, I just wanted to add some context here that, you know, I'm sure everybody has seen the headlines by now that the crypto market as a whole, and I'm using just common language for this, please don't give me any of those whiny comments about Bitcoin and Ethereum are different and NFTs aren't cryptocurrency at all. No, we all know what we're talking about. I don't care what they want to brand these things as. This entire market that was able to be propped up by extremely, extremely low interest rates and a market system where people who had money were trying to find things that were going to balloon up in value because the rate of return on investment and actual existing production has been tightening over the past few years. There's been a huge crisis in the cryptocurrency world. Bitcoin has shed nearly 70% of its value since last fall, which, remember what that means, that all the people who came in late are now using this kind of terminology, they're the ones who are left holding the bag. So they're the ones who are holding this asset, which has depreciated in value. So they bought high and now they're going to sell low, which is the opposite of what you want to do in investing. And this comes after a lot of pariahs and influencers and this entire media apparatus that was pumping up Bitcoin as a surefire thing, crypto in general, Web3, whatever, as a surefire thing. And now we're seeing the floor completely collapsing here. The the total value of these cryptocurrencies has fallen nearly $1 trillion just in the last month, which is down from a peak of $3.2 trillion last fall, right? So this has been historic and massive amounts of loss. Stable coins like Terra have plummeted. Lending platforms like Celsius, which we're going to come back to later, they actually blocked users from withdrawing funds, right? That's how bad this crisis has been. And remember, especially when we're talking about groups like Celsius and these kind of influencers out there, people were being encouraged to take on these leveraged loans, right? Which means if you start to see this kind of depreciation, then you need to start showing up with some collateral, right? This is pushed by these kind of pariah influencer characters who are extremely nasty people. Who are, you know, and now people are having to sell their actual maybe physical assets like their car or a home or something like that to meet the demands for collateral, right? So we've seen an entirely bottoming out of this industry, and we're going to break down a few of the ways that this is affecting everyday people in just a moment. Like, this is the context that all this stuff is happening, and I just want people to remember, like, when Matt and I first started talking about this a few months ago. Right? Hell, not even a few months ago. We've been talking about this for years now. You know, we got all these, oh, you don't understand it. Oh, I'm just sitting here high and mighty on the returns that I've been getting on my investment, right? Why are you guys so jealous? It's because from the get-go, we saw that this was a scam, and was a scam in the most classic capitalist way. All the stuff that, you know, the people like the twins are getting in trouble for, these are kind of financial schemes that have been played with financial assets from the beginning of any kind of centralized capital system, right? And watching this all play out in real time, when we know what happens when the cycle ends, everyday investors, normal people who are scraping up, you know, maybe a couple of grand or something like that, money that's hard for them to come by because they're being told by all these people that this is a sure thing, are the ones who get punished the most. And just lastly, before we move on, Matt, I just wanted to know, just on the sports metaphor, or not metaphor, on aspect, you know, I was watching, and we can't play it here because Yahoo's pretty bad. They get us in a lot of trouble when we play their stuff. But I was watching some of their roundtables they've been having, and they had a couple of these Bitcoin YouTubers on there to talk about the market. And the Bitcoin YouTubers are like, we always knew this would happen. We told people that they needed to be careful and know that this is a long game, not a short game. One guy compared it to the boom and bust cycle in retail, right? Saying, oh, well, I used to sell shoes at the mall in right before Christmas. And I knew at the end of Christmas season that a lot of people were going to lose their jobs, right? So this is exactly the same thing. Well, no, it's not. Because the difference between what you were actually doing when you were selling a physical object to people who needed it, one, just to wear, and two, because people give gifts around Christmas time, right, is actually related to productive activity versus this, which was always a speculative asset. And no, it's not a cycle of like, oh, Christmas or this quarter or that quarter. It's when were the conditions going to be such where people had a lot of access to cheap cash to be able to pump up things like this. And then the crash is when it happens when that dynamic changes. Oh, yeah. And lastly, sorry, on the sports thing, the worst pivot, Matt, ever, right, was after talking about, oh, how he knew Bitcoin was going to have troubles, but don't sell, blah, blah, blah. He then said, well, I'm also going to be launching a Web3 NFT collection for college football players going into the next season. And it hits on so many things for me. So I'm a big supporter of name, image, and likeness. I think that college football players and college athletes in general should be getting paid for all the value that they create. And it's been a horrible exploitative system for a very long time. But one thing that's always worried me about the era that these guys are coming into right now without kind of financial counseling and with a lot of people who are willing to sort of sell this kind of snake oil stuff, is that they're coming to a market that's being pushed by people like the Golden State Warriors, by people like LeBron James, by people like Jay-Z, saying that this is a set and done deal. And all of these guys now are, you know, launching these NFTs for themselves. At a moment when that market is just completely crashing, right? And it just shows you how many nasty people are out there trying to take advantage of folks who might not know, you know, how dangerous and risky these kind of investments can be.
Yeah, I mean, before we get to the Howard Schultz sort of reprise, I forgot about this tweet, but this fucking drove me insane. Haley Lennon on Twitter. I've been saving money the last year for a house. Now the housing market is insanely high and Bitcoin is insanely low. Might go all in on
Lord
Bitcoin
in heaven.
Instead.
Yeah.
This woman is a contributor to Forbes crypto. Forbes, which is like, again, we're talking about like being a dumb guy in Barnes & Noble in our early 20s and not knowing shit.
Yeah.
Forbes is like, okay, I want to get serious about money. I better mm-hmm. read Forbes. So mm-hmm. you got this absolute charlatan going in and saying like, maybe Bitcoin housing, wonder which one it is. And I mean, like, and also come to find, somebody pointed out in the replies to me, Binance invests yeah. in Forbes. So, you know.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
And like, this stuff is a challenge to financial elites.
There are so many threads and trails we can go in that we have to be disciplined.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
there is a thread here that's very important too, that none of this stuff the conditions are set by, you know, political economy, by Federal Reserve policy, by government policy, right? But two, the crisis in media. Right, where media outlets have been so gutted and are so willing to basically do whatever their financiers tell them to do, plays a huge part in this game too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so let's get to Howard Schultz quickly.
Yes, please.
So here is,
and also shout out, we got more Union Starbucks here in Texas and one in Oklahoma City. I mean, that movement is just blazing forward right now.
150, I believe, locations. And we had a Trader Joe's guy organizing. And, you know, like just to hear how workers in different jobs are inspired by, I mean, it makes sense, obviously. But you see Starbucks workers can do it. You see Amazon workers can do it. It's exciting. Here is the famous pitch by Howard Schultz, and we'll go on. There's a new update to this.
Okay, let me give you another tidbit. I shouldn't say this, but what the? Okay. I'm not a digital native, obviously. Raise your hand if you're a digital native. That's not a very strong hand. Who's a digital native? No one? Adam Brotman's a digital native. Okay. How many people have followed what has been happening with NFTs? Wow. How many people have participated in investing in NFTs? How have you done? Okay, for now. Okay. So if you look at, I try to be a student with all this, not being a digital native. If you look at the companies, the brands, the celebrities, the influencers that are trying to create a digital NFT platform and business, I can't find one of them that has the treasure trove of assets that Starbucks has, from collectibles.
So anyway, complete bullshit. Really, really, really.
No, insane. I mean, that's this. You know, that's the ex-CEO of Starbucks there, going on about. We're not going to let y'all unionize. I'm also going to threaten to take away your healthcare if you're trans.
Yep.
As a threat against a unionization effort. But look, me and my friends at the top of this company are trying to find a way to get into this piggy bank of NFTs. And yeah. Only now, this was a few months old, so like only now we're seeing that whole thing bottom out. But I mean, it just shows how out of touch this guy is, and why this was just such a bonanza for corporations just trying to find ways to squeeze as much money for themselves as possible.
Yeah. Now, Jordan Zakarin of More Perfect US. More Perfect Union found this part of follow up here, which is very interesting. I might speed up just a little bit, but this isn't going to go the well.
Rachel Ruggeri, you too. There was a comment online: least boring CFO, Rachel Ruggeri. Okay, who wants to get started?
Linda. Rachel, you blew me away.
Oh, thanks.
Unbelievable.
a compliment.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Here he is.
Hi, my name is Mark. I'm a 10-year partner. I'm a technologist. I've been in technology since I was 12.
Wow.
And as a technologist, growing up, especially in the early O's, I would hop from company to company because technology moves. Why stay in one place? This is twice as long as I've been anywhere. So as a technologist and an open source advocate, because technology should be for people, Starbucks has been super, super glorious to work for because it's about people, it's about coffee, it's about passion, it's about all of us here together, right? Making something better, for making the world better. And not because we're trying to make money, but because we're trying to make people closer together. So when...
Somebody says in the chat, corporations are cultish. And yeah, we will make a little bit of a apology for that.
The technologist comes up and says, hey, you know what? Maybe NFTs aren't a good idea. People in finance, people in marketing would tell you differently. But you should probably talk to the people in technology about what they think. Because first thing you'll learn is that the blockchain, whether it's proof of stake or proof of work, the NFT, the whole thing is not planet positive. Regardless of how you spin it, it is going to destroy the planet, which seems diametrically opposed to what Starbucks is about. And it makes me, as a technologist, and I'm not the only one, very worried about that this company would go in that direction, because I don't want to feel like this about Starbucks. I've enjoyed my time here. I've enjoyed helping build this company with you guys. Too long to watch something as important as keeping the planet alive go completely. You're getting snowed, and I don't want that to happen. So that's my statement. My question is there any way for us to consider finding another way to be more inclusive? Because the other thing NFTs does is excludes people, because you have to be in the chain before you can be counted. You want that for all of us? I don't think that's where we want to be as a company. Just that's my two cents. I'm just going by. But
skip a little bit ahead here so we can see the response.
Yeah, I can take that. Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for everything you've just shared, the passion and transparency.
And that's basically what you get. Like, you know, we'll take that into consideration. But I found that pretty fascinating. Like, yes, you have like the cultish aspect of it. But I think what's underappreciated is how much these companies are doing internal PR to get the people that make their day-to-day operations go on board with what's happening. So you have this crisis for Starbucks right now, where they're union busting and their workers at the actual stores, the people that actually give coffee to people, are saying, we are not being protected by the corporate. And it's fascinating to see like the attempts, like how are they going to try it? What shiny objects do they have to distract the folks from that sort of thing? Like, I'm not sure how much of an ally that guy is going to be on the unionization thing of it, but I just think it's fascinating. Like, the amount of like trouble corporate America is in with fighting off this unionization stuff. And yeah, the NFTs make an appearance.
And, you know, on top of that, like the trouble that, you know, government officials are in from, you know, people like, we always love to play that Booker clip, but Gillibrand too has been pushing this just shamelessly. My own governor here in Texas, Abbott, has taken the disastrous and extremely dangerous step to basically invite these Bitcoin miners into our failing grid. You know, and over this last weekend, we've been hitting highs here, and there's been a lot of worries about the electrical consumption in Texas, that we might be facing blackouts. And thank God, you know, the system didn't fail over the weekend. But when you're thinking about some of these groups that are now like building, taking incredible amounts of energy off of the grid, because they've been invited in by the governor and other local officials to do that, because they can say like, look, we're revolutionizing the system. Y'all wanted to see something done about the grid here in Texas. We have these really interesting fellows who spend their time on the computer doing some stuff over there. I don't really understand it. You know, and And, you know, like, look at this new shiny thing, basically, to try to distract from the crisis. So, like, here the political and social crisis of the grid here at Starbucks, the horrible worker rights abuses, right? They've been using this not only as a way to make money, but to sort of paint themselves as progressive and forward-thinking organizations. And, yeah, I mean, hats off to that guy, because it certainly takes a lot of bravery in that moment to say something. But yeah, I mean, this is just such a theme and a thread throughout all this crypto stuff that we've been covering here, is that it's basically used to distract people from the real fundamental problems, that they're facing.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, because that guy has all the right values, or at least he exhibited there. It's just, you know, you've had a life that you've worked as a technologist at corporations, you know, but like this is why, like, he can't be misanthropic, because people are genuinely good. Like, genuinely, when he said, like, what can we do to be more inclusive because this stuff keeps people out? You see people in the background cheering him on and clapping for it. And, like, I like that. Should we go to Ed's piece now?
Yeah, let's go to Ed's piece, because I think this starts to break down some more of the dynamics here. So this is a piece by the always great friend of the show, Edward Angueso, in Motherboard. The crypto crash just got a lot worse. Investors are panicking. And he basically breaks down what happened at Celsius. But I want to go to the section here, because it really highlights some of the fundamental problems of this entire industry. Celsius is a lending firm that works similarly to banks, but with much higher risk, since deposits are not federally insured. The platform lets you deposit crypto in exchange for abnormally high interest rates, up to 18%. A savings account typically nets 1% to 2%. To pay out such high rates, Celsius takes deposits and either invests them or lends them out to traders and charges a high rate for the loan. Celsius advertises that 1.7 million people have deposited with the service. And, you know, one of the things to note here is that Celsius, when things got bad, they shut down their system, meaning that you couldn't withdraw money from the system, creating a lot of crisis and obviously, you know, kind of psychological fear for people, only encouraging more and more people to pull their money out of crypto. But the most important note to make here is that some of the worst stuff that we've seen with crypto, on top of, you know, the way that it's been marketing to people who don't have the capacity or the capability really to be invested in these kind of risky assets, is the way that a lot of these companies are trying to step in and act like banks that are either federally insured or certainly federally regulated, in ways that they haven't been regulated and they're certainly not insured today, meaning that people have assets that can just go poof like that overnight. Right. And that's extremely, extremely dangerous in any circumstance, but certainly for the people who are advocating that this is some kind of alternative model to finance. Right. That the lessons that we learned, for example, in this country in the Great Depression and almost every financial crisis that we've had, is that it's very important to have safeguards so that the constant boom and bust cycle of capitalism doesn't always fall into complete catastrophe for normal everyday people, because the people at the top, they get taken care of. Right, they get looked after, they get protected. It's people like you and me who get really, really screwed over by this. And the fact that these organizations were even allowed in the first place to be acting in this way is a real, real failure of our federal regulators here. And two, it's just like it completely explodes the whole libertarian fantasy that this is something different. This is the only difference here is that people were able to carve out a new space where there weren't these kind of protections and regulations for normal people in them. That is the innovation here, not the blockchain, not the technology, none of that. It's that there are no regulations, so they were able to do this kind of extremely risky thing with other people's money.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing with Peter Thiel and Blake Masters' 0 to 1, which is you find – and you see this with Uber and stuff like that, right? You find an industry whose sort of brutal exploitation has been lessened over the years through regulation, and you avoid that regulation because tech. Woo! Mm-hmm. We're not a bank. We're a tech firm. We're not a cab firm. We're a tech firm. We're not a this. Mm-hmm. We're a tech firm. And you can avoid all those regulations. It's fucking – that's the innovation. That's all the fucking innovation you've seen in this country is regulatory avoidance. Because the fucking internet exists now. It's really shabby, I think.
So let's go to El Salvador here, because one of the things that I think has always really infuriated me about this entire trend has been the way that poor countries have been sort of targeted by this. From Bitcoin Magazine saying that Palestinians need Bitcoin as a way to avoid apartheid. No, they need to end the occupation there to help Palestinian people. And there's a lot of arguments too as to why it doesn't really make a lot of sense for people in that part of the world to be relying on an extremely, extremely risky asset like Bitcoin, especially in places where you don't always have access to the internet. But we're going to go to El Salvador, where Bukele, who is somebody who has one, I think just has to be noted up top, and we're going to go to a story about him in just a moment. You know, on top of the Bitcoin stuff, which I think he's become sort of famous for in this country, is a very, very cruel and horrific authoritarian leader and should be opposed just on that level. And sometimes I think the Bitcoin stuff overshadows that for people. But remember, they made Bitcoin legal currency, legal tender in El Salvador, and it has been an absolute disaster. So this is crypto, the crypto desk at Bloomberg. They went and they sent somebody down there. This is, I believe, June 5th, so very recent, to go and see how this rollout has been for everyday people.
But the rollout hasn't been entirely smooth. Most businesses are struggling to adapt and say that Chivo is often slow and clunky. Bitcoin's volatile price swings have also scared many away from using it.
Para retiro. No tiene efectivo. No tiene efectivo.
During a recent visit to El Salvador, some Bitcoin transactions took longer than a day to be fully approved, and the fees were quite high. Taxi drivers, watch repairmen, and other small businesses said they still prefer to be paid in dollars.
Just to tell folks what she said there, she said, why not, you know, we have that service here, but why not, why won't I accept that? Because those of us who don't know how to read will lose money.
Yeah.
We can play a little bit more if we want to finish.
Yeah, I mean, that's the end. I mean, it's just other people saying similar things, right? And I mean, this is the note here, right, is that despite, you know, it's one of the points that we've been making, not only about Bitcoin and crypto, but also technology in general. Like, we're, you know, I'll speak for myself, but I'm not anti-technology, but I'm against this kind of technology ideology, right? Where people think that something new is just on the merit of it being new, shiny, and different is going to be able to solve problems, when a lot of the problems that we face right now are actually very, very clear where the problem begins. The problem in countries like El Salvador is hyper-exploitation from the global north and mass poverty that is continued through people like Bukele, who is trying to create, you know, a class system there. When he's talking, when he, you know, makes his triumphant statements, you know, he was out the other day saying, oh, it's time to buy more Bitcoin, and you're seeing huge losses for the country's treasury, which is extremely damaging in a country like El Salvador, though it would be in any country. If you were like, fuck, could you imagine if we were just like losing part of the federal budget because Biden had like invested it in cryptocurrency?
To the moon, man.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't accept that because you can't run a functional system on an asset as volatile as Bitcoin, or one where the technology just doesn't work, as they were saying there, where transactions are taking over a day to complete. And it should be noted, too, that Celsius, one of the excuses that they made was a transaction was basically taking too long to process and holding up the entire system. Right, so this is something that just could not build out functionally as currency, and it never has been currency. It's always been an asset. That's always been a BS claim.
And for things, what? For what? Like, why are you waiting longer to do technology magic? What the fuck? Like,
I know. it's despicable and it's disgusting. And again, like this kind of ideology, like, oh, we're going to give people this new technology and that's going to solve the problems. It's like, no. These problems are very, very simple. We've known them for a long time. It's capitalism, France. And let's go here on Bukele, because we're going to come back to the Federal Reserve in a second, because that's where a lot of these the Bitcoin people are going to start going. But I want to start here because it has to be noted. This is a piece in The Guardian. El Salvador accused of massive human rights violations with 2% of adults in prison. More than 36,000 people arrested in over 2 months and crackdown orchestrated by President Nayib Bukele. If you go to the next one here. Amnesty International has accused El Salvador's government of committing massive human rights violations during an extraordinary security crackdown that has seen more than 36,000 people arrested in just over 2 months. The clampdown was orchestrated by the Central American country's authoritarian-minded president, Bukele, in late March after a sudden eruption of bloodshed that saw 87 murders in a single weekend. Bukele's response to those killings was swift and severe, with pro-government lawmakers approving a draconian state of exception, which entered into its third month last week. This week, Bukele's security minister, Gustavo Villatoro, claimed 36,000 people have been detained since the war on gangs began, 31,000 men and 5,114 women, right? There's just no question here that, like, this is just basic law stuff, that you can't just do these kind of mass arrests and detention, because more often than not, you're going to be pulling in people who are completely innocent. And even for people who are guilty of crimes, you're completely ignoring their basic rights to due process and a fair and just legal system. And it just has, I just want to note that up here when we're talking about El Salvador, because I think it's important for people to also remember the package that this kind of Bitcoin shit comes in, right? It is these kind of anti-democratic, authoritarian figures, from people like Bukele, who leads a country, to these kind of right-wing libertarian organizations here in this country as well.
Yeah, I mean, that is a lot of arrests. And like, what is his – yeah, I mean – yeah.
He's been targeting the left. He's been targeting indigenous groups. We'll do more on this in the future, yeah. But I want to make sure that we talked about that here.
Yep.
But to end this, let's talk about the moment that we're in. We could pull this down for a second, Matt. To end this, I want to talk about the moment that we're in. And this all stems the crypto wave, right? The excitement around it, the money that's been pumped into it, has happened in a very peculiar dynamic in American capitalism in particular. It has happened in an era of extremely cheap money, but not only have the interest rates been low, the Federal Reserve has been playing a huge role in buoying up the economy. And there's no doubt that there's a connection between the incredible rise of things like Bitcoin to the incredible rise of tech stocks. We note Tesla all the time on this program. Tesla, a car company that doesn't really produce cars in the first place, being, you know, valued more for a time than car companies that produce more in a month than Tesla does in a year, right? And that kind of stuff happens when you have mass speculation, and that is the kind of stuff that happens when you have free-flowing, easy money. But as we've seen from the Federal Reserve, we talked about last week how Powell has said his goal is not to come for the bottom lines of these super rich people. It's to make life extremely difficult for poor and working class people, and to target wages with the hope that wages will go down so you have a more servile and less rebellious workforce in this country. Remember when the Volcker Shock happened in this country, it set this country in the 70s, right? It's setting this country down a trajectory that we're still in today, where wages have never recovered that harsh austerity that was imposed by the Federal Reserve. And it always has to be noted, in addition to what happened domestically in the United States, the Volcker program created mass crises across the developing world and created a debt crisis in Central America and South America. And guess who comes in to save the day? The IMF, World Bank. And what does that come with? All these stipulations about how you have to run your country, all these stipulations, all of these basically forced austerity programs on other nations, right? These have always been attacks on growing power for the left, for workers, and for independent countries. And as we're starting to see the Federal Reserve start to, you know, roll back a lot of these things, pay attention to the effects in the rest of the world. So a lot of people are talking about the rate increases that we have, that we're seeing. They're going to increase interest rates, which is going to have extreme knockdown effects for all of us. But it also has to be noted that the Federal Reserve is trimming its $9 trillion balance sheet. And that has been absolutely critical for keeping the economy afloat during the slowdown from COVID and after the financial crisis. And it's certainly also responsible for the frothy nature of speculation, because these things aren't just dials. You know, you move the dial one way to the right and the economy gets good. You move it a little bit to the left, it gets worse, right? These things have knockdown effects and they don't hit everybody equally. So during this period of like very cheap money, the Federal Reserve basically stabilizing prices for assets, it meant that people who are in that class, asset holders, people who have relationships with banks, people who have lines of credit, it got really, really easy for them to pursue highly speculative, risky activities. Now, for the rest of us, very, very little positive has come, but it prevented a complete falling out of the system, which would be devastating for everybody, right? And now we're seeing the Federal Reserve, which has been playing a very, very active role in the Treasury market. You know, it's been stabilizing prices. But now because it's scaling back those activities, it's creating crisis. And the real crisis that we could see is if the Federal Reserve pulls out too much money out of the system. And if you could put up this last bit up here, Matt, this is from the Financial Times. I think it just breaks it down very well. When the Fed buys bonds, it electronically credits the seller, in turn adding reserves to the banking system that then enable banks to increase their lending to individuals and companies. By ceasing to reinvest the proceeds of its bond portfolio, the process reverses, leading to fewer reserves in the system and tighter financial conditions. And what does that mean for everybody else? It means that corporations are going to face a squeeze. And what do corporations do first? Do they cut the CEO's salary? Do they cut back the waste that is going on in the company? No, they target workers. And workers are going to be the ones who are going to face the brunt of this kind of restructuring of the economy. Workers are going to be the first ones who are hit. And it should be noted, again, the Federal Reserve did historic stuff during the COVID-19 pandemic, from buying corporate debt to its role in the Treasuries market, historic intervention from the Federal Reserve. But again, what class of people did that benefit? It benefited the rich and the powerful in the society. That money wasn't coming to you or me, right? And now what the Federal Reserve is doing is creating a system where the punishment is going to fall on the backs of workers in this country and workers all around the world. So when you hear the Bitcoin bros, I don't want to call them the Bitcoin boys, right? Complaining about the Federal Reserve, because they already are, right? There's two things to note. One, I thought y'all had an independent financial system that wasn't attached to the real economy. But the most important one is to note that no, y'all got into the situation because of Federal Reserve policy that was benefiting a specific class. And yes, what the Federal Reserve is doing right now is absolutely devastating. But what the real devastation is what it's going to be doing to workers, not what it's doing to little freaks who are trying to bamboozle people and trying to trick people so that you could make a bag while the rest of us suffer.
Absolutely.
Well, we got, I'm sure we'll have to do a lot more on that. It's tough because every bit of me wants to just do this big victory lap, but it's, I can't do it because it's painful to see, some of the reactions from people who have been roped into this scam. It's painful to see some of the real trickle down effects of people like those sellers, in El Salvador. And it's going to be really, really devastating, as Americans are setting themselves, are having to prepare themselves for what looks like a very, very serious, blow of austerity, coming from the Federal Reserve's, policies here. So there's going to be, it's just tough to be like gleeful, that we were right about this.
It's funny. We can't be gleeful about it being right about everything about it. We can't also just leave it alone like we've wanted to, because more and more people that are high and higher prominence are Kirsten Gillibrand and fucking Loomis from Wyoming got together, did a bipartisan bill, basically giving crypto everything it wants, mm-hmm. For security. So you can trade this absolute bullshit securely and blah, blah, blah. That's just another version of that. So, it's here to stay, I think, until it goes kerplunk for good, which, I mean, going to be a wild day.
Totally. We're going to go to our conversation with Derek Davison. and Danny Bessner. We're going to be talking about Biden and American foreign policy and a little bit on Ukraine. We're looking forward to sharing that with y'all. Also remind folks that we're doing our summer streams. We're going to be joined by my good buddy, Rob McPherson. Leave us a voicemail, 1-940-289-7234. People on Patreon can leave us a Discord question, and we'll be trying to take some stuff from the chat. So if you have anything that you want to say, save it for the Twitch stream right after the main show finishes up, probably around 8:35 Central Time, around there. But until then, let's watch this interview with Danny and Derek.
Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. Howdy, David.
Hey, man. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. And joining us once again, two guests. Have we had them together before? It's hard to know.
I don't think we've done it together. No.
Derek, have you been on the show?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, thanks, guys.
Danny Bessner and Derek Davis.
I have my own life. I do think that.
I don't like to hear that.
A little envy happening.
Yeah, two great hosts of American Prestige, Free Speech Warriors. They moved it off of Patreon to the free speech platform of Substack. Always good to have y'all hanging out with us.
Yes, welcome, folks.
Yeah, happy to be here. First time, long time.
Conceptual James is joining the show. I wanted to break that news here on your program.
That'd be good for him. I mean, honestly, I would look to the results of that experiment. yeah, this is how Yemen is CRT. On that front, David, how do you want to start this? Do you want to give us a little background, or should we go right into Yemen?
Well, I think before we get to Yemen, it might be good to just sort of frame the America's relationship with Saudi Arabia. So, just recent news, Joe Biden is going to be heading down to Saudi Arabia to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to try to, I don't know, reset the relationship after he called it a pariah state after the murdering and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. I mean, could y'all give us just, a quick, we don't have to go into the weeds or anything, just primer for people who might not be following the relation between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, sort of what's happened over the past couple of years and where we're at now?
First of all, how dare you? Second of all, I'm going to throw it to Derek.
I mean, look, our best, closest allies with the most, that honor our values in terms of human rights and democracy. No. So, I mean, it's no secret. I mean, people know that the Biden administration, well, the Trump administration was so embedded with the Saudis in a way that was gross even by historical U.S. standards. They were, joined at the hip. Mohammed bin Salman and Jared Kushner were like working together to shape the Middle East of the future, which sounds terrifying, but I mean, luckily I'm not in the Middle East to experience that. The Trump administration arranged the Abraham Accords, which allowed Israel to normalize relations with a number of Arab countries, the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, all in exchange for goodies from the U.S. for all of those countries, and all to the detriment of the Palestinians who get thrown under the bus. And that was part of, I think, although the Saudis, for a variety of reasons, didn't participate in that process, it was part of Mohammed bin Salman's vision for the future of the Middle East, a vision where Arab states align with Israel to counter Iran, and for economic reasons. The Trump administration and the Saudis were very tight. The Saudis have put like $2 billion in Jared Kushner's investment vehicle now. So they own him pretty much. If Donald Trump comes back in 2024, be wary of that. Biden, I think mostly for rhetorical reasons, because he wanted to sound tough and he wanted to appeal to, people who were upset about that relationship during the campaign, talked about treating the Saudis like a pariah state because of mostly the Jamal Khashoggi murder of tens of thousands of Yemenis, I guess, didn't rate as highly. But, you know, partly for that reason as well. Once he got into office, I mean, you know, over the last year and a half, it's been a steady progression from sort of ignoring, not the Saudis, but ignoring Mohammed bin Salman. There was this insistence for several months that Biden would only talk to King Salman because it's a head of state to head of state thing. He wouldn't talk to the crown prince because crown prince isn't on that level, even though he's the de facto kind of day to day ruler of the country. But as gas prices have gone up, as oil prices have gone up and gas prices concurrently, most recently, you know, spiking because of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Biden has kind of desperately been trying to contact Mohammed bin Salman to beg for more oil production, which is a dubious prospect, but he's been asking for it. Mohammed bin Salman had until recently been ducking his calls by all accounts, just kind of ignoring him, I think, to prove a point. But now this trip is announced. It seems like, you know, both sides are amenable to putting the relationship back together to some degree. There's a lot of speculation that Mohammed bin Salman is, you know, kind of openly working for Republicans at this point, or rooting for a Republican, you know, victory in November, and then for Trump maybe, or whoever, to win in 2024. So who knows how far they're going to be prepared to go. But the trip itself indicates that things are, you know, we're trying to get back together.
I mean, it's just worth noting that on this trip, Biden's also going to be visiting Israel. So, you know, he's going to be meeting with two countries that have killed American journalists in recent memory.
Yes, that's true. Shireen Abu Akleh, the her killing, which by all evidence I've seen, even CNN said looked like it was a deliberate killing by Israeli soldiers in the West Bank. So, yeah, I mean, this is the axis now in the Middle East. I mean, it is the dominant axis, Israel and the Saudis. Even if they won't talk openly about being aligned with one another, they clearly are. The Biden administration would love, I think, to expand the Abraham Accords to include Saudi Arabia and get that relationship on the track to normalization. It would be a huge, they would regard it at least as a huge diplomatic coup and sort of one-upping Trump, because Saudis are the mother load. And they did just help broker a deal over a couple of islands in the Red Sea, transferring them to Saudi control, which is, you know, could be a stepping stone to something bigger. But I mean, I think, you know, other than oil, it'll be a trip to talk about the Iranian menace, which you can put in all caps, and, you know, what can we do regionally to arm ourselves to, you know, for in case the Iranians try to swarm over the Middle East or something.
There was an option not taken that some people were excited about with regards to Venezuelan oil. And that leading to more diplomacy. Was it ideological or practical reasons that Biden didn't take that route?
I honestly don't know. They sent a team to Venezuela to talk about this at least once. It seemed like they made some progress. The Venezuelans, I think, released a couple of prisoners, and you know, there was talk that things were going in the right direction. I don't know if it's a just purely a political calculation. I suspect that's it, because Biden has not shown a lot of willingness to court controversy with, you know, important voting blocks in the United States. And the Venezuelan expat or exile community is fairly important in some states. He hasn't shown much willingness to take on any of those blocks in any respect in terms of his foreign policy. So I suspect that's the reason. I mean, there are other factors. Maybe, you know, Maduro is you know, holding off on meeting with Juan Guaido, you're kind of pulling and dragging his feet on that, which is supposed to be part of the process. He's supposed to be participating in talks to kind of patch things up with the opposition. But I don't know, you know, beyond what's been reported, which is just that nothing happened.
You gonna say something, David?
Oh, I mean, I just wanted to remind folks too about like the technical aspect of oil production. So, like, when, you know, Venezuela's production capacity has just been decimated for so long, it takes a lot of time to get those things online too. So, like, even if Biden was willing to accept, you know, more Venezuelan oil, if it were to be something that would be viable in the sense of like lowering prices in the U.S., it would probably be something that would take at least, you know, 9 months to a year to be able to ramp it up, and that's even partway.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at the point where it wouldn't matter much for the midterm, so maybe they just figure Who cares?
How badly do you think the Dems are going to lose in the midterms? Is it going to be like an all-time blowout? It seems that way, right? It seems like an all-timer, this one coming up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's truly amazing to me, the kind of political malpractice. I mean, you know, people who know the show and stuff probably, you know that we're not big cheerleaders of the Democratic Party at all. But it's just been amazing to sort of watch them sort of, you know, I mean, Sleepy Joe's the leader, like sleepwalk into this election with a very, very engaged right-wing base, despite having, I don't know, so many like domestic political wins that they could be, you know, knocking up in the months coming into the election.
Well,
for one... Yeah.
And they're going to like take the air out of the tires of something that's would energize their base with doing this bipartisan gun thing, which McConnell would only do if it was like threatening the giant wave he was expecting. So, of course, it's basically just like the bipartisan infrastructure bill, but for guns. Like, we're going to take the air out of the tires of the thing that would actually threaten us politically. And, you know, anyway, that's probably enough on the Democrats.
I feel like the level of geographic polarization at this point limits the extent to which you could ever see a wave election again. So I don't think they're going to get rinsed as badly as things might indicate, because structurally I just don't know that that's a possibility anymore. I do think they're going to do as badly as you can imagine under the way the system is set up now.
Don't they, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but don't they kind of rely on like the youth vote and things like that, things that are just, they're going to get very, very low this year.
And on top of that, like, you know, Biden's, you know, success in beating Trump was very heavily reliant, you know, on this kind of suburban strategy. And the thing, especially like southern suburban areas, like those are just not loyal voters. So, I mean, I don't know if it's going to, you know, we're going to see Brooklyn turn red or anything like that. But a lot of people who are very key in Biden's, you know, victory in 2020, they're not going to shell. I mean, they all voted Republican down ticket. They voted for Biden at the top. So, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, it is looking very, very bad. And I think, Dana, your point there is like well made too, that like what they've done to youth voters basically since coming into office has almost been worse than how they were treating them before, you know, when Bernie was running, right? Y'all are complaining too much, pie in the sky stuff.
It's depressing to watch, isn't it? To just watch them like go through the motions. They're not even trying, really. It doesn't even seem like they're trying to court anybody. And they do rely on youth votes. I think to whatever extent there are swing states left or there's swing districts left, the youth vote is the thing that puts Democrats over the top when they can get a large number out. I just don't know how much of that sort of thing exists anymore. I think they're going to lose, but I think there is, for both parties, there's so much kind of, you know, separation now that both parties have a sort of minimum floor that is probably higher than it used to be in the past.
Yeah. That's why we at American Prestige are writing in Nicholas Kristof for every position. Yeah.
Everything. Yeah.
I mean, if we're making predictions too, what I think is really worrying is, you know, here in Texas, in South Texas, seeing what happens there. Because Republicans have been able to make pretty significant inroads in the past two cycles with, you know, Tejano voters. And the Democrats are just trying to run this, I don't know. It doesn't work there because they try to do identity politics. But like, if everybody who's running there is like Tejano Mexican American, you know, you can't really get too far. Like saying, well, I, you know, represent these people on an ethnic basis. If you're running against somebody who also comes from that same community, so like that's really worrying, I think, nationally, but even more so, like internally here in Texas as we go into those ledge elections. Seeing more Republican control of the state, you've already seen what they've been able to do over the past 20 years here, cementing it, frankly.
And I'm wondering to what degree this sort of lack of effective messaging is connected to the rise of a national consultant industry where people come in and perish. I don't know, but it's interesting that one of the reasons why Democrats might be so bad at local elections is you basically have the federalization of this industry, which is now extraordinarily influential.
I mean, I totally agree there. I mean, just again, like in 2020, you know, Biden won most of those counties, right? But Trump was able to pick up significant margins. And people who were there on the ground were literally just like pleading with the state and National Democratic Party saying, like, they're out here in full force. There's billboards. There's a lot of energy and, you know, activity here trying to, you know, convert these communities to the Republicans. And, you know, the Democrats' response was basically like, well, no, like, the voters, they're Hispanic and they're always going to vote Democrat forever. And like, that's just one of those things where you realize that, you know, somebody sitting in Washington, D.C. probably doesn't know about, like, the, you know, very specific culture and history and community in South Texas or, you know, anywhere else in the country.
Well, and that's also related.
Go ahead,
just very quickly. And I think that's also related to the sort of meritocratization. You know, back in the day, you'd have regional industries, yeah. You know, now if it's just all these people go to the same 25 schools. And so, you know, it reflects that the sort of lack of regionalization, which I actually think we're going to see a return to, because I think the Republicans are going to dominate the structure. And I think you're going to see, I've been saying this elsewhere, but a return to liberal federalism.
Yeah, I mean, well, the other thing to note about consultants and stuff like that is they get literally like a fee for placing media ad buys. And so the profit there is a lot easier than setting up some sort of organizing center in a strip mall and actually being there every day. It's, you can just run some ads on TV and you collect a check.
I don't even, like, I'm curious, and I don't pay attention, you know, I pay attention more to foreign policy, obviously, but, like, what is the message even at this point? Like, I know what Republicans want to get elected to do. They want to stop, you know, vile Maoist Joe Biden from turning the United States into, you know, North Vietnam or North Korea or whatever. But, like, what's the message from Democrats? Like, give us more seats and we will. It's like they're turning a dial, basically. Like, do you want us to do something about guns? Do you want us to codify Roe v. Wade? What do you want? We'll do whatever you want, even though they've had chances to do all these things in the past and didn't. I don't know what their message is other than the Republicans are dangerous. You know, dangerous Donald is coming back. And
ding, yeah. You nailed it. I mean, here's Biden 2 hours ago tweeting, ask yourself, how well are you going to sleep at night knowing that every 5 years, Ted Cruz or other congressional Republicans pushing ultra-MAGA, which has backfired already as a term, ultra-MAGA policies are going to vote on whether you'll have Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. That's their plan, which is like, again, like, that's their plan because we don't have a plan that we can actually allow.
Yeah, I mean, like, that sounds scary, but, like, do you guys have anything you want to do proactively, or are we just playing defense from now until the end of time as the Republicans slowly claw all these things back? Like, that's such a shitty message.
And, like, it's just so – not to fixate so much on South Texas, but I think it's, like, it's an interesting case study here where it's, like, ironically, like, Republicans are being able to pick up, like – you know, social spending points with folks. So, like, for example, in 2020, when, you know, people who traditionally vote Democrat voted for a Republican, they did, you know, they went to the ground, people got interviewed, and, you know, there's a lot of stuff, like, I'm worried about the border, or things that you would expect. But there was also things like, hey, you know, that guy Trump sent me $1,200, and that really helped me and my family out. Yeah. You know, we could want to be like, oh, no, you know, it's Congress, the Democrats are really behind it, but, like, then run on it, for God's sakes, right?
Yeah, I mean, people don't see it at that granular level. I mean, and what a great message, like, tweets like that are for, you talk about the youth turnout. Like, the message of that tweet is everything peaked like 20 years ago and we're just in a steady decline, and you can vote for us to, like, slow the decline down, but it's just going to keep getting worse. And I mean, how's that supposed to bring people, inspire people to come out and vote?
Well, it's insane. That's job, like, guys. I mean, the we got this situation with Brittany Griner, the women's basketball player who's incarcerated in Russia right now, and she's locked up for weed. And it's like, Biden could be right now taking action to end that domestic bullshit here, and he's just not, because he said he wouldn't. Like, he ran on not doing that shit. And it's like, well, okay, what do we have for young people now? Like, you don't want to do any fucking material, like, financial stuff, because you want to
get at least let people get high.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, I mean,
if you have to work during a pandemic, I want to be blazed.
How about, like, the standard is, if you've ever referred to marijuana as jazz cigarettes in your lifetime, you are too old to run for office, and that's, you just have to retire.
Or, I mean, like, you know, just since we're talking about Joe Brandon, like, you know, so there's that tweet that Matt just pulled up, and I don't have it handy, but, you know, Joe Biden put out a tweet a couple days ago, too. It's like, what is my plan on inflation? and his plan on inflation was to let the Federal Reserve do its job, right? Which is very much geared at like a very specific audience of folks, right? Who were mortified by Trump even maybe suggesting that he was going to put some level of like public pressure on the Fed to keep interest rates low. You know, I do sometimes wonder, because, you know, I have to say, like, Biden, I think we know what we're getting with him. But this is somebody who's been around politics, I think, long enough to you would at least would expect that maybe he would have better instincts with this. But maybe he is. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But I also wonder that, like, the people who are really advising him and pushing him on these things are like the people that Danny was talking about, who went to the same 25 schools. And like, that's a winning message for that group of people, is like, we're going to have the Federal Reserve be independent of politics. But it certainly is not a winning message for the general public.
I don't know how good his instincts are. I mean, how many presidential campaigns did he lose before winning basically by default because of COVID, and even then underperforming what people expected? I don't know that his political – I mean, he got elected as the senator from MBNA, and he took care of the banks, which was enough to stay in office in Delaware. But, does he actually have good political instincts? I don't know.
I mean, the ice cream stuff's pretty good, but
yeah. And if he can just be catty about Elon Musk, I think like that's his best part. But kind of on Biden's instincts, like it is like he's sort of like the captain of a ghost ship or something like that. That they're just like floating through the world. Like we already mentioned. I forgot how I was going to make that transition, but I want to bring this to Yemen.
just
ghost ship was a strong start, though, Matt. I was excited to see where that ended.
I had an elaborate ghost ship metaphor, but anyway, we had this situation with Obama, if you could just remind us about why we're involved in supporting Saudi Arabia in Yemen, but just a sort of a preface to that, Obama got involved in expanded sort of border security and enforcement because he wanted to send Republicans a message like, hey, I'll do this for you. You work with me on DACA and immigration reform. A similar sort of thing got us involved in supporting Yemen. Isn't that right, Derek?
Yes. I mean, the trade-off in Yemen was, Obama was negotiating the nuclear deal at the time. This was 2015. The compromise I think that he offered the Saudis was, if you don't make a big stink, because you recall, I mean, like, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu was giving speeches to Congress about this deal was going to lead to nuclear war or whatever. So there was international pressure from Israel, and I think to avoid or to minimize the pressure that was coming from the Gulf, the deal was basically like, look, we'll support the war in Yemen. We'll give you we'll keep selling you weapons. Ostensibly, there are rules about these things not being used in an offensive campaign, but nobody pays attention to that. We'll fuel your planes. We'll give you targeting, intelligence to basically do the logistical work of supporting the war effort if you don't make too big a stink. I mean, they still made a little bit of a stink, but not a huge one about the nuclear deal. So that was the trade-off. And then, of course, the war in Yemen turned out to be the world's greatest humanitarian catastrophe. And the Trump administration pulled us out of the Iran deal, so we weren't getting anything anymore for it. We were just wholeheartedly supporting this atrocity, this ongoing atrocity. And that's, where things stand to this day, basically, although there is a ceasefire now, which is somewhat promising.
Yeah, I mean, the just early in the Biden administration, when we started calling him the press release president, he had announced that we're not going to be supporting any offensive actions in Yemen. And of course, that definition is you need to look very closely at what the word offensive means in that context.
I people yelled at me on Twitter because I tweeted something like Biden's not going to do anything about Yemen. And it was like the same day that he said, we're going to end support for offensive operations. And I was like, oh, shit, that was wrong. I guess that was wrong. But here we are, a year and a half later almost. And really nothing has changed. I mean, again, for the last two and a half months, we've had a ceasefire. But prior to that, there was no indication that anything had really changed.
Well, on that, I mean, talking about changes, We had Kurt Hackbarth on last week to talk about the Summit of the Americas, which, you know, I think is fair to say now was a big embarrassment for Biden. And it is going to be interesting to see if this kind of signals any kind of shift in America's influence in that part of the world. I want to hear y'all sort of, you know, general sense and feeling about how, you know, if you're seeing a shift or if it's too early to say, with Biden and his relationship to the Americas. Before we go there, I wanted to play this clip again, which is the new press secretary talking about the fact. So, you know, AMLO doesn't go. A lot of other leaders don't show up to the summit. And it becomes apparent that, like, one of the headline moments of this event is going to be Joe Biden meeting with clown fascist Bolsonaro. But just here's how seriously and well-versed the press secretary is on what's going on in the Americas. I'll just play this real quick and hear y'all's reaction to it.
President Bolsonaro of Brazil, the AP reporting that the Brazilian government, President Bolsonaro, wanted specific concessions from the president for that meeting and for his attendance at the Summit of the Americas, that he wouldn't bring up Bolsonaro's casting doubts about Brazil's election system, as well as environmental concerns in the Amazon. Can you confirm that report?
I cannot confirm that report. The president is looking forward to leaving tomorrow to head to the summit that we are hosting. I can say this, the United States continues to recognize Juan Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela. That said, while the interim government was not invited to participate in the main summit, they are welcome to participate in all three stakeholder forums and other events.
Right on top of it.
Yeah, she just didn't. I think she just didn't know, right? Like that. She just didn't know.
I think 100%.
I mean, she didn't know. You think it was between Brazil and Venezuela? Apparently,
yeah. She just wasn't ready for that. Or do you think that was like a deft? Not especially deft, I guess.
No, it wasn't deft. I mean, may have been a deflection, but. It was a bad one if it was intentional.
We try not to be cynical here on this show. So Matt and I, the first couple times we saw that clip, you know, we took it seriously, you know, in the sense of like, oh, well, maybe she's trying to bolster, you know, some kind of feelings amongst like the right wing and, you know, the Americas or, you know, internally in the United States. But then after watching it a couple times, you realize like, no, she had no idea what the question was really about. I have these notes right in front of me. And I'm just going to read this statement now.
Yeah, she's sort of vamping in the beginning. Like, he's very excited to go to the summit that we are hosting.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that information. Like, press secretary.
Waiting for something to come in. And then, yeah. I mean, you know, the mispronunciation, which, you know, it happens. I do it all the time on the show, butcher people's names. But Guaido, I was like, is this the sequel to Total Recall? Like, is there, is he the brother of Guaido? Like, what's going on?
It made me think of Ace Ventura when he eats guano, the bat poop, and he's like, yummy.
But, you know, I mean, this, you know, obviously, and as Kurt sort of broke down for people, you know, it's not like the Summit of the Americas has historically been this like grand exercise and like diplomacy and, you know, everybody coming together. But there was, you know, the move, you know, really pushed by AMLO and others seemed to have been effective. And as we're seeing, you know, the possibility of maybe more left-wing governments coming into power in the, you know, in South America and Central America. I'm just curious if y'all feel, because one, it seems like the Biden administration isn't particularly concerned with that part of the world, except as something to use to sort of like rile up their base or to deflect any criticism that they might get from, you know, Miami, you know, Cubans or Venezuelan diaspora. But I'm curious if y'all have any feelings about the dynamic so far.
Yeah, I think that's my sense as well, that Latin America is a major focus for the administration. I think even in the response to Ukraine, you could still see that the administration is mostly focused on China and the rising great power competition. And either for that reason or because they view Biden as personally weak, I think a lot of Latin American leaders have recognized an opening where they'll be able to push this administration for things that they might want at the local level. But if we're looking at from the structural level, the relationship to me seems essentially unchanged, in that the United States is still militarily and economically dominant in the region. Mm-hmm. So that they'll may be able to be some move on the margin, questions, barring shift in the other Latin American policy or relative U.S. power, which I don't see as necessarily on the immediate horizon, I don't think that structural relationships changed.
I think it's a weird dichotomy, because on the one hand, there is this like obvious level of indifference. And I would point to the fact that supposedly one of the big goals of this Summit of the Americas was to put together a regional deal on migration. Mm-hmm. And you know, the decision not to invite Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela then prompted not just AMLO, but Xiomara Castro in Honduras to boycott the presidents of Guatemala and El Salvador, a friend of the show, Nayib Bukele. Both skipped for different reasons. I mean, it wasn't because of the Cuba thing, but skipped for their own reasons. So you had none of the four leaders, regional leaders, who actually directly are involved when it comes to migration attending this summit. And the Biden administration's response was like, it's probably fine. No big deal. So it's clearly like some level of indifference. On the other hand, you know, as Danny mentioned, there is this focus on China, and there's a concern about China in, you know, countering China in East Asia, in the South Pacific. There was just a like really wild article in the New York Times the other day about was basically like who lost Fiji, like the United States has allowed Fiji to fall into China's orbit. Like, oh my God, what can we do now?
That's where Jim Carrey wanted to go on the German show.
There you go. And Latin America, same thing. I mean, China has made, you know, I think other than Mexico, there was just some report that came out this week that said, you know, Latin American trade with China is far outstripping interactions with the United States on just a commercial level, other than Mexico. And so there is this kind of sense that they do want to counter China in these regions and, like, you know, be present. And but they've come up with nothing. I mean, they've launched these two like frameworks. Biden did, you know, did his Asia trip last month and had some framework for prosperity. And then he, you know, at the Summit of the Americas, his big announcement was the America's Partnership for Prosperity. It's like all this prosperity talk, and there's no meat on any of it. Like, there's nothing, there's no indication of actually what these things are supposed to do. So I feel like, you know, they want on the one hand to be there and kind of contesting these spaces with China, but on the other hand, they just don't have anything to offer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting, you know, in the Americas, at least, because I do agree with the point that, like, when it comes down to, like, you know, material realities, like, nothing's really changed in the sense of American power still dominant. But, you know, it's an interesting moment, right, where you're seeing all this pushback. I mean, AMLO, you know, has even said that, you know, the American blockade on Cuba is genocidal, right? Which you would feel would be like a big deal. But at this moment, it still feels like most of that pushback is, and I don't think that means it will always stay there, but most of that pushback seems to still be mainly like symbolic and speech making and that kind of stuff.
I would agree with that. I mean, look, you know, even AMLO, when he, you know, sort of made his big announcement that I'm boycotting the Summit of the Americas because of this injustice, like in at the same event was like, but I'm going to go to Washington next month and talk to Biden. Like, don't worry. It's not going to be, you know, I'm not really serious about this. I'm going to still on board with everything. So, yeah, I mean, it does seem a little bit for show, I guess, on some level.
Yeah, always look at the structure. Don't look at just the singular events.
Well, kind of on that note, could you go in, Danny, a little bit more into the great power interest in Ukraine? And, you know, I mean, just my osmosis intake of this conflict seems to be Russia making more moves, advances than they had been early on. What's your guys' take on that?
Sure. Well, Derek could tell you the specific details. He really keeps up with it more than I do, more than it probably anyone on earth does. But I just think that the lack of but the lack of overwhelming American military response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine indicates that the administration, I think, is trying to keep its eye on the ball, which in my mind is really trying to counter the rise of China as a hegemon in East Asia. So there'll be weapon shipments and things along those lines. But really, I think the U.S. is still focused on that. That's really what I meant by that. But I don't know, Derek, if you disagree.
I mean, there have been moments in terms of the administration response where you can say, you know, this is about China. It's like about China more than it is about Russia. Like very shortly after, I mean, within a couple of weeks to a month after the invasion, they've dialed this back somewhat now. But there was this very strong push from the administration to like point the finger at China. Like, why aren't you condemning this invasion? Why isn't China standing up and trying to stop the Russians? And what's wrong with China? Like making it about China when it really wasn't, you know, it's really not about China, but they clearly wanted to sort of make that part of the story. And it didn't take, I don't think, very well. So they kind of dropped it. But I mean, I have seen, you know, these sort of stray comments from always anonymous administration officials that wind up in the news here or there, you know, talking about, well, we, you know, this coalition that we're building, like, I mean, they're not really building, it's not really much of a coalition, but, you know, we want to keep this coalition together after this war is over to focus on China. And so, I mean, it's still, that's still front and center, I think, in their minds.
You're muted, Matt.
No, I just said interesting.
I mean, I won't put you in the position of making any bold predictions or anything like that, but could you give people, you know, a little bit of a sense of, you know, how the Russian military operation is going up till now?
It's going better now than it was for them for the first month and a half. This attempt to do, you know, a sudden quick strike on Kyiv and, like, you know, seize all the country's major cities and everything, that was a bust, mm-hmm. clearly. But now that they've focused on the Donbass and basically they're going like one city at a time, they have, I mean, they can outmatch the Ukrainian military even with the level of support that they're getting from the West now. Russia still has, you know, they can afford to lose more soldiers in a kind of, you know, war of attrition. They have better supply lines to get ammunition to the front line. They have more heavy artillery, which seems to be very decisive here in a war of kind of, you know, we don't really care how many casualties, I guess, mm-hmm. anymore. It's just about territory. So now that they've gotten to this sort of grinded out phase, they are moving. And I don't think they're moving. I mean, I don't know what the plan is at this point, really. Mm-hmm. I haven't known ever to a certainty, but I don't know what the point at which they will say, this is, you know, this is good, we can stop here, even if it's just to pause. I don't know where that is. But certainly if they still have designs on, like, seizing half the country or, you know, three quarters of the country or whatever, I think they're moving too slowly for that. It's mm-hmm. not sustainable the way that they're going. But if all they want to do is sort of secure the Donbass and maybe a little bit of territory, you know, more territory in the south, and then, you know, park themselves for a little while, then they're in pretty good shape at this point, I would say.
Do you think?
And it's inscrutable at this point whether there's any you know, openings for diplomacy or end.
Well, I mean, nobody's talking. So, yeah, I mean, I, you know, what would you have to talk about? I mean, the sort of diplomacy that can end a war, it tends to take place when both sides come to the conclusion that things are not going well for them and they would be better off putting the war, you know, to bed. But what you have now is sort of a lopsided thing where the Ukrainians have lost a substantial portion of the country, and they're not going to be willing to, you know, give up at this point and say, okay, you can have what you've taken so far. They're mm-hmm. clearly unwilling to do that. I mean, Zelensky keeps talking about taking back Crimea, which is outrageous on some level, but you can understand why he keeps saying it for political, ideological reasons. And the Russians are still advancing, so they don't have any reason to talk either. I don't think it's a great time for that.
And, like, do you think that if it does turn out to be, you know, a prolonged grind, obviously I'm not trying to put you in the position of making a bold prediction here, but you know, your sense is watching the kind of American response, most importantly, like the political response. I mean, do you have any fears of, you know, a significant, you know, American push to move from this kind of, you know, we'll give you a little bit of intel and some weapons here and there to something that would be a little bit more overt in the coming months if it ends up being, you know, this kind of long grind in the Donbass?
I mean, I think it's already that's already happened to some degree. I mean, you've seen the Ukrainians go from like we want, you know, stingers and javelins, things that we can kind of use in an insurgency type of war, to asking mm-hmm. for howitzers, which we've provided. Then they've asked for multiple rocket launchers, which we've provided in small numbers. The ask is going to get bigger, already has gotten bigger. Mm-hmm. You know, they were just, I just saw something, I think yesterday they were asking for like 300 multiple rocket launch vehicles, you know, and like 500 tanks and 1,000 howitzers. They're not going to get that, but that's the ask. And then, mm-hmm. you know, that puts pressure on the U.S. or the UK or Germany, whomever, to say, well, we can give you this much. So I think, you know, right now you've already sent them, you know, I think maybe 10 of these rocket launch systems and some other heavy artillery. It's only going to get easier now that you've kind of broken that barrier. It only gets easier to say, well, okay, they need more. We can send mm-hmm. more, and they'll keep asking for more, and we'll keep sending more. And then, you know, you're into drones now. I mean, there's been talk of selling advanced drones to the Ukrainians, U.S. drones. You know, so that's, yeah, I mean, I think the potential for that is quite high.
What about escalation concerns? You know, there was that story, you know, when it comes up that we're offering intel, there was that story about that turned out to be false by Charles Savage about the bounties placed on American soldiers. And like, it felt like that was kind of conditioning us to like really respond to something like that, like to justify a really extreme response to that. Now Russia, like, I'm just curious, like, escalation, it seems like there's less concern about this escalating into World War III than I was hearing before. Is that just, are people just like taking that reality like that no one's worried about that anymore? Like, what's this prospects for a you know, worrisome escalation?
A lot of that talk happened in the early phases of the war, and I think it was mm-hmm. before people got a gander at the Russian military. And now that they've sort of gotten bogged down in eastern Ukraine, and I don't say that to mean like they're stuck. They are advancing, you know, clearly, but very slowly. I just don't, you know, what would they have to gain at this point by bringing NATO into the war? I mean, this was, you know, sort of premised on kind of fears that there was going to be this huge, you know, lightning strike across Ukraine and the whole country was going to fall. And then the Russians would start looking at like Moldova or, you know, some other, you know, outside Ukraine. And then they were going to push, you know, against even harder against NATO. That I don't see that happening at this point. So, yeah, I think, you know, there's talk that they might use a tactical nuke in Ukraine. Even that, I don't know what the purpose of that would be. And it always seems to be some like ex-US general talking about this while like secretly hoping that we can open up, you know, start using you know, get into a nuclear exchange for some reason. So I don't see it as as big a threat as it might have appeared early on.
Well, Derek, thank you so much for hanging out with us, and Danny as well. People should be sure to check out not only American Prestige, but also Foreign Exchanges. You can get on Foreign Exchange on you can get both on Substack, actually. You can get American Prestige at Substack. Be sure to sign up for that because you get a lot of really great bonus content. I mean, before we leave y'all, would y'all want to give folks a little flavor of what's coming down the pipeline in the next few weeks?
So we've got another episode in our History of the IRA series. I think this week's episode is going to be on contemporary politics in the Philippines. We've got more in our Afghanistan series. Derek, am I missing anything? I must be. That's a good flavor, at least.
We've got a bunch of stuff coming up later in the summer, but We have a mailbag episode.
Hell yeah.
sort of the bottom of the barrel. But we did, we have more episodes in our Kurdish series. And we just did an interview last week about Eurovision that I guess we might do.
Oh, yeah. We should put that one out soon. Yeah.
Alex Avinia's series on Guerrero, the Mexican state of Guerrero, is ongoing. So we've got a bunch of stuff and more planned for July and August.
Well, hell yeah. Well, everybody, we'll put links below for you to be able to follow them and their work. Thanks again, y'all, for hanging out this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Hell yeah. Good dudes there.
The boys. Yeah. It was nice. I liked Danny kind of flipped it back on us and made it conversational with
yeah.
Talk about the Democrats.
He's a free spirit. Fun. No, that was a lot of fun. Definitely be sure to check out American Prestige. I think more coming from there in the near future, too. And yeah, we're not done at all. We're about to jump over to Twitch, twitch.tv/leftreckoning. We're going to be talking about this really, really embarrassing loss for the Democrats in South Texas. We got some vintage, no, I guess it's not vintage, it's a couple weeks old, vintage by internet standards. Cornel West speaking at the protest against the Summit of the Americas, some Bernie, and also the ultimate lad, my good friend, Rob McPherson, will be joining us, and we'll be taking your questions from Discord, from the chat, and also your voicemails. So be sure to join us over there, probably in like 5-10 minutes tops. We'll be ready to go soon.
See you, folks.
All right, we'll see y'all soon.